You're listening to HuntertonChamberRadio.com, sponsored by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce. Our studios are located in the CenturyLink building at 14 Mine Street, Flemington, New Jersey. The content and views of our hosts do not necessarily reflect the views of the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce. To contact our station, call 908-782-7115 or email onair@hunterdon-chamber.org. Thank you to our sponsors and underwriters. Please remember to support them and buy Hunterdon, buy local. Visit www.hunterdonchamberradio.com for a complete listing of our programming.
Moving forward, giving consumers more money to spend on other things. Meanwhile, income grew 0.3% in January as worker pay increased. Analysts expect solid job gains and low unemployment will boost consumer spending and economic growth this year in what they predict will be the fastest pace in a decade. Matt Small, Washington.
The U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments in a case involving voter-approved commissions that draw a state's congressional district boundaries. Arizona Republicans are objecting. The big issue before the court is whether voters can take away the power given by the U.S. Constitution to elected state legislatures. The decision could affect 12 states. This is USA Radio News.
You hear that, kid? That's the hum of a well-run facility. You know what I hate hearing? Silence. Silence on a production line means downtime. Downtime means wasted time. Wasted time means wasted money. Silence isn't golden, kid. It's deadly. That's why I love Grainger. With a wide variety of the latest products, Grainger gets us what we need when we need it to help keep this place up and running and humming away. Get it? Got it? Good. Call, click Grainger.com, or stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Kentucky Senator Rand Paul has won the Conservative Political Action Conference's annual presidential preference straw poll, his third win. He spoke about America's priorities during the event.
We need a national defense robust enough to defend against all attacks, modern enough to deter all enemies.
And he says the U.S. should not be bogged down by what he calls nation building.
We should promote stability, not chaos. In the Middle East, one form of tyranny often replaces another. When secular despots are overthrown, chaos ensues and radical Islam grows stronger.
He says it is possible to protect the country while also defending civil liberties.
To defend our country, we need to gather intelligence on the enemy. But when the intelligence director lies to Congress, how are we to trust them? Are we to trust them to collect and hold every American's phone records?
Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker came in second place, followed by Texas Senator Ted Cruz, retired neurosurgeon Ben Carson, and former Florida Governor Jeb Bush. Forbes says that Bill Gates' net worth rose to $79.2 billion in 2015 from $76 billion last year. That put him at the top of the magazine's list of world's billionaires for the second consecutive year. The co-founder of Microsoft has topped the list for 16 of the last 21 years. I'm Kelly Sloan, and you're listening to USA Radio News.
The news is sponsored by Patton, Heidi & Associates, a financial advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc.
Americans believe they should be in charge of their own future, how they'll live tomorrow. Since 1894, Ameriprise Financial has worked for their clients' futures, helping millions of Americans retire on their own terms, when they want, where they want, doing what they want. Today, Pat and Heidi & Associates, a financial advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., remains true to the vision of always putting clients first. They are ready to help you put a confident retirement more within your reach. Put the strength of a leader in retirement planning to work for you through a personal one-to-one relationship. Pat and Heidi & Associates will work with you to develop a plan to help you achieve your retirement goals. Call today at 908-713-6600. That's 908-713-6600.
The weather today is going to be mostly sunny with a high near 37. Northwest winds 16 to 18 miles per hour with gusts as high as 30 miles an hour. And tonight will be mostly clear with a low around 12 degrees. Northwest winds 8 to 11 miles per hour, becoming light after midnight. Tuesday, more of the white stuff. Snow likely before 5 p.m. Then snow and sleet likely. Mostly cloudy with a high near 33. Calm winds becoming south 5 to 8 miles per hour in the afternoon. The chance of precipitation is 60%. new snow and sleet accumulations of less than an inch is possible. Tuesday night, snow and sleet before 9 p.m., then rain and sleet between 9 and 11, then rain after 11. The low will be around 33, southwest winds around 10 miles per hour. The chance of precipitation is 90%. New snow and sleet accumulation of less than a half an inch. Wednesday, rain likely, mainly before noon. Cloudy with a high near 46, west winds 9 to 11 miles per hour. The chance of precipitation is 60%. And the new precipitation amounts of less than a tenth of an inch is possible. Wednesday night is rain, lightly before 1 a.m., then snow likely. Cloudy with a low around 27. Chance of precipitation is 60%, and the new precipitations amount between a half and three-quarters of an inch possible. Welcome to Mental Health Matters. I'm Larry Cartwright, your host, and this is NAMI's Hour. NAMI is the National Alliance on Mental Illness, and we're on courtesy of the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce. NAMI, there's a NAMI chapter in every county in the state of New Jersey, every state in the union, and overseas. And we try to help families and families who have a member of their family who has a mental health issue, and people who have mental health issues. And we run classes. In fact, my wife and I are teaching one right now that just started this past Thursday, which is called the Family to Family class, and it'll run for 12 weeks. It is totally free. If anybody would like to join, you still have a chance. All you have to do is call 908-735-4465. Speak to either myself, Larry, or my wife, Priscilla, and you can come to this coming Thursday. We also do a lot of presentations, and we try to break the stigma attached to mental illness. Now, we are very privileged today to have with us Melissa Grohman. Am I saying that right, Melissa?
Yes, you are.
Okay, good. She is a licensed clinical social worker. I can speak, actually. I'm just having trouble now. She is a licensed clinical social worker, and she's also a psychotherapist. Now, Melissa specializes in eating disorders, relationships, and healing emotional pain. She has 25 years of experience and recently has written a book entitled Better Is Not So Far Away. Now, I want to first of all thank you for coming on with me, and also thank you for your publisher sending me the book. I've gotten three quarters of the way through it. I will finish it, I promise. But there's been some personal stuff going on. My youngest son has a mental illness, but he also is going into the hospital today to have minor surgery for, I don't know, a stent put in for his kidney stones and whatever. So my wife is over there. So as soon as the show's over, I have to run over to the hospital. So I would have loved to finish it, but I got three quarters of the way through it. And I think it's an excellent book. I really do. How did you arrive at the title for the book?
Well, first, thank you so much, Larry, for having me. The title of the book was sort of a cooperative venture between my editor and myself. There were a lot of titles bounced around. My working title originally was You Can't Make Me, because it's so, sometimes it's just so frustratingly difficult to decide to recover from an eating disorder or to figure out, you know, especially with, you know, disorders and addictions and mental illness, what we can do and what we can't do. And so it was sort of a nod to how frustrating it is. But the publisher said, you know, let's give it a different bent. And the theme of the book sort of came to be that, you know, we can get better, things can get better, and that it's not as far away as it can seem when we're suffering and all the knots that can come with emotional pain and mental illness.
Yeah, like I said, after reading three quarters of the book, I don't want to lie and say I read it all, because I haven't. I read three quarters of it.
I'm happy you got three quarters.
Well, I got three quarters of it.
You know? I was laughing in appreciation that you got that far. Thank
well,
you.
I did, and it's interesting. And I, you know, looking at it from a, let's say a person who is suffering from the type of illnesses that you cover, I think it reaches out to them, and you know, speaks from experience, which I guess is my next thing, because I gathered from, you know, reading what I read of your book, that you're speaking from some personal experience. And I was wondering, you know, like, would you describe a little bit? You don't have to go into a lot of detail, but if you would, a little bit about the experience that you, because I gather that you had some issues there also, and that's also been entered in the book from what I could gather.
Yeah, I mean, sure. The majority of the book is really not so much about my personal story, although it's woven in there in different pieces, mm-hmm. in different chapters, you know, enough so that, you know, folks can know that, you know, I know what it's like to suffer from the inside out as well, and certainly have had many different experiences with many different kinds of emotional pain, and I had an eating disorder for most of my adolescence into my early 20s, and still consider myself a recovering food addict. So part of that is reflected in the book, although, you know, most of the book is really about the subjects, you know, dealing with emotional pain and recovery, and but my stuff is in there too.
Yeah, and, you know, I, on numerous, not I won't say numerous, but, you know, four or five times I've had a psychologist on from New York who specializes in depression and bipolar. And she's the person Dr. Oz calls when he has a mental health issue. And she writes, asked a doctor for Esperanza Magazine, which is a bipolar and depression magazine that comes out. And, this doctor, like I'm going to say to you, like I said to her, she suffers from depression, has been hospitalized a couple times. And when she's speaking, like you, when you're speaking to clients, you've walked the walk, you know, and you've talked the talk. So it's like, you know what they're going through because you went through it.
Yeah. You know, I always think that nobody gets it like someone who's got it.
And exactly. It's true, though.
It's true. I mean, everybody's story is unique and has some unique bends and twists to it. But I think that when you felt it from the inside out, there is a shared human knowledge. And I think when it comes to emotional pain, most of us can relate because it's so human.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there are specifics. And when you've got it, you get it. So.
And, you know, when someone comes to someone like yourself and either, you know, over the phone or personally or whatever, and you are speaking, well, I know what I know that feeling because, you know, I've had it and yada, yada. It sort of breaks a wall between the client and the, you know, and the therapist because you've been there, you know. And I think it's awesome. And I think if more therapists, I don't say suffer from disorders, but if more of them could know more and live more like, you know, a person in suffering, I think, you know, they would get through to their clients a lot better. Maybe I'm wrong, but I just happen
no,
to think
I
so.
I think that it's true. I agree with you. And I think that there is an element that comes to one's work when one has an inside view of it.
Right.
And again, with respect to the fact that everybody's experience is different, but, you know, when you have your own idea of what that suffering is like, then your compassion and your empathy is a lot broader.
Exactly. Just like, I don't know if you heard before, I was saying that my wife and I are teaching a family-to-family class. And
you did. It sounds very compelling.
And it's a 12-week course, totally free. But the point is that we as teachers of this course, or facilitators, whatever you want to call it, we've been there. We have four children. I understand you have five, so you beat me by one. But we have four children, and our youngest son has schizophrenia. And he was hospitalized for a little over 2.5 years continuously, was in and out of the hospital numerous times after that. So we've been there. And when we're talking to these families who are coming, who are maybe just starting to go through it, or who are just had their loved one had their first breakdown or whatever, we've been there, so we know, okay. And we're talking from experience, just like you talk from experience. And I think it helps. It really does. I think it helps put the person who you're talking to, like in our case, the families, that we understand. We understand their frustration. We understand their anger. We understand their confusion. We understand that they don't get it sometimes, you know. And it makes it that much more reciprocal for them to receive the information from someone that has been there.
100%.
You know, and so I just throw that out because I feel that it's important, you know, for anybody out there who may be considering going to someone for, you know, therapy or, you know, whatever, who has eating disorders or relationships or emotional pain or whatever is cutting or whatever, that you might not be a bad person to get a hold of, you know, because you've been there, you know. When we will give out your, you know, you can give out your information in a little bit, you know, as to how to get a hold of you. But eating and cutting disorders, are they like, abusive traits such as alcohol, drugs, et cetera, and is used as an escape, in your opinion?
Yeah, you know, it's a great question, Larry. It's so, you know, and it's controversial. I mean, a lot of people have different takes on it. You know, I think, you know, what is the nature of addiction and what is the nature of cutting? And they've got similar tenets to them. I think that they're abusive in nature to ourselves, but they're also a way to save and to heal and to escape. And they work. You know, if they didn't work, you know, they wouldn't be employed. You know, we do them because on some level they help us to deal with just, you know, difficult feelings and difficult life. And on some level, at some point, they stop working. You know, in a way, they protect us for a while, or so it seems, and then they outlive their usefulness. And that's when, you know, folks usually come around and say, you know, look, this has got to stop. This isn't working the way it was. It's not the escape or the comfort or the emotional regulator that it was. And the trouble it's causing is, you know, way, way worse than the way that it's helping.
Right, right. You know, occasionally I go to the local hospital here, is Hunterdon Medical Center, and they have what they call two central. It's a lockup ward. And I go up there and talk to the patients. And about a month or so ago, I finished talking to them and interacting with him and so on and so forth. And I, pardon me, I was leaving and this young man come up to me, and if I had to guess at his age, I'd say 21, 22, no more than that. And he started to talk to me and he says, well, I want to show you something. And he pushes up the sleeves on his shirt on both arms up to his elbow. I haven't seen anybody that had not one piece of skin that wasn't scarred on both his arms.
Why was he showing you? Do you know?
Well, we were talking and we were saying about, you know, what works and what doesn't work, and you know, what you can do sometimes to help deviate from bad behavior and so on and so forth. And and he showed me this. And I don't get shocked too often. I was beyond words. I couldn't say anything for a few seconds. I was just looking at his arms, and I swear there wasn't a piece of skin from his wrist to his elbow on both arms that was not scarred. And I'm saying, like, my God, you know? And we talked and everything, and, you know, hopefully he followed some of the recommendations I made. But you know, it's just – and then he was saying that the pain in his head was so much more than the pain when he cut himself.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that got me, you know, that the pain in his head was so, so much more than the pain when he cut his arm.
Yeah, and that's a lot of folks who cut will say that the emotional pain is so much harder to tolerate, and that physical pain is a way of regulating, and it's almost hypnotic. You know, it's a way to get out of your head and focus on something else. It's a way to know you're alive. It's a way to just kind of deregulate, you know, and just calm down or get yourself out of your own internal pain. There's no other way to do it, which is why in some ways it's functional.
Yeah, except, you know.
Except not.
Yeah, except not, right. I mean, it is in that instant, I would guess, you know.
Right.
But long term, it certainly isn't. And
well, there are a lot of other ways to do it, which is, you know, what I like to talk about. You know, that's the conversation, really, is that, you know, the pain is real and it's powerful and it's potent, but there are other ways to deal with it other than, you know, the battlefield of the body and obsession,
right.
Obsessive thinking.
You know, while we touched on it, would you explain, like, the difference between pain and suffering?
Yeah, you know, it's such an interesting topic, and I like to talk about it. I think that, you know, what I've heard said is that suffering is pain without meaning or purpose or progress. And I think that, you know, if we're just endlessly suffering, and emotional pain, you know, is really a kind of suffering, especially if you don't see your way clear or you can't figure out what's ever going to be. And it also feels like, well, it's in your own mind and in your own heart, so you ought to be able to snap out of it, which isn't true. There are ways to move through it, but the snap out of it is not really something that's workable. So I think that the pain itself, you know, can be part of life. It can be integrated into, you know, whatever that pain is, whether it's pain from grief or loss or anything that's going on with relationships, with those close to us, with just life itself. But when that pain has a purpose and when we know what to do with it and when we're able to feel it and let it pass and deal with the thoughts that are underneath that pain and the pain itself, it doesn't linger and become a pointless, endless, hopeless, you know, gray road.
Right, right. But with emotional pain, maybe you ought to explain what emotional pain is for somebody out there that may not know exactly first. And then I'll ask the question.
since I write and speak about it, I should have a handy definition of it. I mean, I think to me, emotional pain is all of the bad feelings that we have that just have us by the throat, that feel really bad, really pervasively all the time and don't pass so much. I mean, really intense rage and anger, jealousy, hopelessness, loneliness, endless grief. And grief doesn't have to be endless. Grief has a very valid place. But when we're in a very dark place, certainly depression, resentment, when those kinds of feelings are just present with us all the time and we're sort of there, worthlessness is another big one. When we don't understand our value, when our creativity is blocked, when we don't see our purpose in the world, when we don't feel like we have anything to contribute, when everything feels really dark and low, when it seems like there's no point, when we're caught in obsession or fear-based thinking, frightened of things, when our thoughts just are ruling us, our negative thoughts, our fear-based thoughts, that's emotional pain.
And how does that react to dealing with difficult thoughts and feelings? I mean, is it, do you know what I mean? Am I expressing it right? Or
yeah, I mean, I think that the back and forth between thoughts and feelings is an important one. I think that a lot of times our pain is caused by our thinking, and not always. I mean, my own personal take on it is that there are some feelings that are feelings, and mm-hmm. we really should pay attention to them and
right.
use them as guideposts. You know, I mean, like jealousy, for example, can really help us to learn a lot about where we feel deprived and what we might like to achieve in life and what we value and what we think is worth spending our time on. What would we like to have and how could we attain it? You know, at its worst, it makes us feel like we're left out and less than, we don't have anything and everyone else does and we don't and those kinds of things. So I think when we pay attention to some of the very quiet underlying thoughts, we can learn more about what our pain means, and then it can be a pivot point. We can start to see, do we really believe that? Where does that idea come from? We can get curious, well, what is that thought? Is that an accurate thought? Why do I believe that? Where do I get that idea from? Whose voice is that really? You know, what does that really mean? Mm-hmm. Is that a fact? Like, we can ask some really important questions and start a curious conversation about, you know, what's underneath some of our feelings. So I think there is a connection between definitely a connection between thoughts and feelings.
Yeah. It's like, I don't know, there has to be, well, like you were just explaining, I believe, you know, in some cases, there's an upside to the difficult feelings, you know.
Yeah.
But how do they use those? How do people use those feelings, you know, as like a guide?
Yeah.
You know, and that's.
And I think that's part of the, that's part of, you know, kind of getting better is, you know, I mean, is how we act on those feelings. You know,
mm-hmm.
Clearly, if we act on anger and in a way that's destructive to ourselves or to somebody else, then, you know, that goes back to suffering, because then, you know, what's the point? But if the anger can open us up, you know, and instead of close us down, if the anger can be productive, I mean, there's certainly a lot of things that have come out of productive anger, you know.
Right.
A lot of good things, you know, a lot of good advocacy and human rights have come out of productive anger.
Sure.
People saying, no, this is unjust. We won't stand for this.
Well, basically, that's how NAMI came about. You know,
yeah, I was just thinking, you know.
That's pretty much how it came about, you know.
Yep.
People got tired of, you know, not having enough funding and monies and understanding of what their loved ones was going through, and, you know, and that's pretty much how it came about.
Right, which gives that kind of, that is an example of pain that doesn't have to be suffering, because it's a purpose. It's an amazing contribution to our culture and to society and to being of service and helping other people who suffer
mm-hmm.
come together and have a purpose. It's not meaningless anymore.
Right, right. And, you know, it's, I pretty much know the answer to this question, but do you find that some people with these disorders, they also suffer from mental health issues?
I'm guessing that's your answer also, that sure.
Yeah,
100%.
Well, I mean, not everybody, I wouldn't think, but I would think a good percentage of them, you know.
Yeah.
You know, if so, when someone comes to you like that, do you treat both of them?
Yeah, of course. I don't think you can treat one without the other.
Mm.
And it doesn't have to be a straight line. I think that, you know, the process is really to have a good dialogue about, you know, what's needed and what might be useful and what hasn't worked and what might work. And,
right.
And I always like to talk about what's in the way, you know, and
mm-hmm.
and to see. And sometimes just the unpacking of it can help things to get better. You know, the goal might not necessarily to be that all of a sudden everything is cured. I mean, sometimes that's not, you know, that's not the path it's going to be. But how to live better with the things that we have.
Yeah, you know, a lot of times, you know, people, you know, when I do presentations and such, and people say after, well, you know, I was depressed for, you know, over this or this, and I'm saying, yeah, everybody gets depressed. I don't care who you are. You know, you lost your job, you broke up with your girlfriend, you know, whatever. There is depression, okay? I said the difference between the illness of depression and the average person depression is the length of time.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
When I was laid off years ago, many years ago, I was depressed for a week. I didn't want to go out. I didn't want to do anything. I didn't want to look for another job. I didn't want to file for unemployment. I didn't want to do this. I didn't want to do that. Because I was like taken back that it, you know, me, they let me go, you know,
yes.
And, you know, all the choices they had and they chose me, you know, but the fact was that after about 4 or 5, almost 6 days, I said, hey, Cartwright, you got four kids, a wife, a mortgage, car payments, you got real estate taxes. you better get out there and find a job. You know, so it wasn't, you know what I mean? And so that's depression, but it's not what we're talking about, where it goes on for months and months and months, you know? So.
And then, you know, clearly you tapped into an internal resource that said, hey, I could be resilient here. You know, this happened to me, but it doesn't have to define me. It's not a definition of who I am. It's not the only thing that exists in the world. And,
right.
You know, I think that when we get stuck in depression for a long time, we tend to think that that's what it is. You know, there's no hope. There's no way out. It's okay for other people, but not for me. I'm the exception. You know, something inside of you said, no, I have responsibilities. This isn't going to be the definition of my life.
Exactly. And, you know, it's, could you explain to the public the difference between binging, overeating, or starving, or whatever the three? You know, sometimes I think people confuse the three.
Well, you know, they're confusing. I mean, especially the first two. And with eating disorders, there's a lot of different shades. And for someone to be on a path to figure out, you know, am I a compulsive overeater? Do I just eat compulsively? Do I overeat? Do I binge? You know, where am I on this spectrum? And I think that most people, particularly, I want to say most women, but I really think that most men also, all of us have some sort of place on the spectrum of what we do with our food and, you know, what is, you know, just normal food and life and what slips into disorder. You know, and certainly binging and overeating are, you know, there's a fine line, and it's such a personal definition. But to me, you know, a binge is really a very out-of-control, short amount of time, repetitive, just getting as much as you can as quickly as you can. It's like you have to have it. You can't not have it. And you're going to have it, and the thought impulse is eat it, you know, have it, keep eating it. You can't stop. You can't not. And it's huge. And slowing that down to a point where you don't have to have it, or you want it but you can choose not to, being able to not be at the mercy of that, you know, of that addiction or that compulsion, however one defines it for oneself, you know, that's the work. Compulsive eating is similar to that. You know, it's an urgency. It's, you know, and in the moment, I have to have it. I can't not. And there's no slowing it down. It's just, it's like, you know, the thought is like lightning during the day. You know, it's there. Eat it, have it, take it. You want it. You know, just, and food is so compelling, you know, it's so available,
right,
and so pleasurable,
right,
and so easy to get, and you know, it's difficult. It's in front of us all the time. It's just an easy source of pleasure and escape and satisfaction.
When somebody,
so, you know, overeating is just, you know, a lot of folks overeat. It's good, they keep going a little bit.
Yeah, I'm one of them. No,
yeah.
Yeah. As my chest used to be up by my chest, and now it's over my belt. But
there you go.
But I have an excuse. I'm older.
There you go. Right.
But not really, but you know, I am older, but that's not an excuse.
Right.
But you know, it's when someone eats or overeats or even eats just a little and then forces themselves to throw up. What is the relationship of that with the other, you know, binging and so on and so forth?
Right. Well, you know, again, there's a spectrum, and I didn't talk about starving, which, you know, is another end of the spectrum, which is, you know, a different way of using food or nourishment or lack thereof, you know, in a way to regulate feelings and to have an identity, and it's sort of a different end of the spectrum of dealing with food and body image, and I think the slippage from overeating into binging is, you know, where it becomes takes on more of a life of its own, and the pain of it is more present. You don't want to, but you're doing it. You feel lousy. You're not comfortable in your own skin.
Mm-hmm.
It becomes a way of dealing with all of your feelings and all of your emotional pain. So now I'm forgetting what you just asked me.
That's all right. Not a problem. What I had said was where does, when somebody eats, whether it's a little amount or a large amount, and then goes in the bathroom and forces themselves to throw up. That I think has a name, but I can't think of what it is off the top of my head. Bulimia, that's it.
Bulimia.
I knew it had a name. I just couldn't think of it.
Yes, that's the name. Yeah, and bulimia is really when you get caught up in the purge cycle. And people purge in a lot of ways, not just throwing up. I mean, there's the over-exercise.
Absolutely.
And all kinds of things. And again, it has kind of a double life, you know. It's about trying to get rid of the food because of a terrible fear of fat and of gaining weight and a frustration of wanting that soothing and wanting the pleasure and or being addicted to the food and using the food as an escape and then knowing that the consequence is probably going to be weight gain if all that food stays in. So there's sort of that life number one of, oh, my God, this is all in me and I can't stand it and I have to have it out of me, and purging it all and trying to get rid of it and being caught in that obsession with body and weight gain and it just all being out of control and trying to control it. But there is another side to bulimia, which is, you know, a way of escape through, you know, it is hurtful to oneself, but it's a way of getting clean in a way of feeling like it's gone, it's out of me, I fixed it. It's a way of, you know, sort of being alone. In the book, I talk about it a little bit as, you know, being like a private, you know, underworld, all your own, like being your own genie bottle, you know, where you just,
right.
And it's a compulsion, and it does, you know, biologically create certain, you know, hormones, and it can give you a feeling of being high. I mean, you come down from it, and when you come down, you usually come down pretty hard, and of course, it's, you know, it's horrible on the system, but, you know, it is a way of regulating difficult feelings when the feelings are overwhelming. It just kind of, so it has a couple of functions.
But it
usually leaves you kind of, you know, thrown over the rocks and washed up on the shore, exhausted. So,
one of the we do a PowerPoint when we do a lot of our presentations, and one of the things is this 23-year-old young man who was 93 pounds and died during the night in the middle of his 1,000 sit-ups he did every night. And, you know, when his mother was asked, and she said, well, you know, he's 23 years old. I don't watch him dress or undress or whatever, you know. And she says he could cover up his weight loss and so on and so forth. And you look at his picture from when he was prior to this and his picture when he was, you know, shortly before he passed away.
Yeah.
And it's just sad, you know, really, really sad. But we have to take a quick break. You're listening to Mental Health Matters, and we're very privileged today to have with us Melissa Grohman, who is a psychotherapist who specializes in eating disorders and relationships and healing emotional pain. And she has written a book, which I said I got 3/4 of the way through, and I plan to finish it, titled Better Is Not So Far Away. And we shall be back in just a few moments, so hang in there.
Did you know that 1 in 5 people are affected by mental illness? NAMI Hunterdon is the locally affiliate for NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. We are all volunteers, and all our programs are free of charge. We offer Family to Family, a 12-week course for families that have an adult member with a mental illness. Another popular program is In Our Own Voice, where individuals who are living with mental illness discuss their challenges and their progress in overcoming those challenges. Another course we offer is Basics, a 6-week course for families with a child or an adolescent who has experienced mental illness. We also have a monthly support group for families on the third Thursday of every month. Please call NAMI Hunterdon at 908-284-0500 for more information about any of our programs or to join. NAMI Hunterdon, the voice for mental health in Hunterdon County.
Hi, this is Ruth Ann Disatel, celebrant officiant with Celebration of a Lifetime. When people ask me why I joined the chamber, it's because I want to get to know you and what you're all about. And I want you to get to know me and what I'm all about. And together, I'd like to celebrate what we can do for Hunterdon County.
Hunterdon Chamber of Commerce, building business, one business at a time. Are you tired of the limitations of your small office shredder? Do you need to be compliant with federal regulations regarding the disposal of sensitive information? Are you concerned about identity theft? If so, then call AssureShred. AssureShred will provide your company customized on-site document destruction service that fulfills regulatory requirements and at the same time protects your organization from the consequences of the improper disposal of sensitive information. To obtain a free quote or to schedule an appointment, call AssureShred at 877-466-1566 today. That's 877-466-1566.
Welcome back to Mental Health Matters. I'm Larry Cartwright, your host, and we are very privileged today to have with us Melissa Grohman. And she is a psychotherapist who specializes in eating disorders and various relationships and healing emotional pain. She has also written a very excellent book, at least three quarters of it that I read is excellent, called Better Is Not So Far Away. I would assume people who have these disorders and they're dealing with these disorders, I would assume they're vulnerable.
Vulnerable, yeah. I mean, it's true, vulnerable to a lot of things. Vulnerable to physical illness, vulnerable to things just hurting more than feels bearable. I mean, I tend to, you know, actually when I talk about vulnerability, in terms of being a vulnerable population, sure, but I also, you know, I talk about the upside of vulnerability, which vulnerability, I'm trying to say that.
Better you than me.
I'm just stumbling over it today. But, you know, that it's okay to be vulnerable in certain ways. And I think that sometimes, you know, when we're in the deepest part of the darkness of these disorders, we tend to think that, you know, we have to be strong and that there's no room for mistakes or faults or slip-ups or just humanness. So I like to actually talk about vulnerability in a personal sense, not necessarily from a societal sense, that, you know, when we can say how we really feel, if we can get there, and, you know, sometimes in the deepest part of an eating disorder or an addiction, it doesn't feel like we can. We've got to put on a show so that we're the only ones that know what's really going on inside. But, you know, there's a really big upside of vulnerability. Vulnerability. Can't say it, Larry.
We understand what you mean.
you know what I mean.
Right.
Everyone knows what I mean. That it's so relatable. You know, it's so human to see that, you know, nobody's perfect and that we all have, you know, we all have our private pain and our private questions, and when we can put that out there, it makes us more relatable, and sometimes, you know, that can be very relieving.
Would you explain willingness to recover?
I like to write and talk about willingness quite a bit, because I think that sometimes we don't feel so willing, especially if we've got some kind of vice or addiction that in some way is hurting us, but we really experience it as helping us or as part of our identity. And, you know, we see this a lot with eating and body issues, that there's willingness, but not really, because it feels like, you know, you really can't get to the other side. It's just too hard. It's, you know, it's too big. The pain is too real, or the habits are too entrenched, or the food is too strong. The calling for the food, or whatever your drug of choice may be, is just too strong. And sort of think we would get better, but we're not really willing to do what we have to do. So I think that one of the things that I often bring up when it comes to willingness is that sometimes the pain of whatever we're experiencing, either the frustration with certain relationships or the disappointments that we feel or our own fears about our self-worth or our value or what we can do in this world, we tend to stay in those emotions, and they get in the way of being willing to do some of the things that we could do to move us forward. We can't really imagine, like, is it really better? Would it really be better if I weren't so involved in this? Would I still be safe? Could I even imagine life without my food or my drug or, you know, living outside of dealing with the feelings like this? So it feels like, look, this is what's working. This is what I know. This is where I'm safe, and I'm not actually willing. So yeah. I like to, you know, I like to talk about it because I think before we can get better, we have to be willing to do certain things. But before we can be willing, we have to really honor the fact that when we're in a lot of pain, we don't feel so willing.
Exactly. Exactly. How do people deal with their friends and their parents and family when they're trying to go through recovery?
You know, it's not easy. There are two. I don't know if you've gotten to those two chapters. I actually think that the better stuff in the book is at the end of the book because I paced the book to talk about all the hard stuff at the beginning. So by the time you get to the end, it's like, oh, really? Okay, good. You know, there's some ideas here, but you know, because I do think you have to go through the pain to get to the better stuff, and the better stuff does have to incorporate dealing with family and friends. And sometimes family and friends can add to the problem. Sometimes they are a big part of the problem. The frustrations in those relationships and the way that dialogue goes in those relationships can be really frustrating. And a lot of times there are family and friends who are well-meaning and who have the right words to help us along and who deal with us in a way that, you know, we can relate to and we feel supported and loved and helped by. And other times, you know, you can feel like you're being told what to do or someone doesn't really understand and you're really all alone. And the feelings that come up in those relationships can actually send you right back to the behavior that's hurting you because it's, you know, it's just so frustrating. You go back to what's privately yours and what you know.
Right, right. And I think that, too, a lot of times some families just don't get it. You know, it's not that they don't want to help, but they just don't get it. You know, as I'm sure you're well aware, mental illness is a chemical imbalance of the brain. And I know many, many families who will come to our support group or whatever, and they'll say, well, you know, 6 months down the road, you know, so-and-so will be all better. Well, you know, they may be better, but it'll never go away. You know, my son will have schizophrenia for the rest of his life. You know, it's not so much that he may not wind up in the hospital again, but he'll have it. You know, it's not like it goes away. You can improve it. You can live a full life, you know, but it's not like it's gone, you know. And, you know, besides actually reading your excellent book, what are some of the most traveled paths to recovery? Is it seeing a therapist or?
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, the first next right thing, place to go when one can is exactly what you were just saying, you know, is coming to some sort of acceptance. You know, I used to always think that acceptance was the end of the line, that, oh, I have to accept this is my problem and this is what it is and therefore the end. And in fact, acceptance is the beginning. Mm-hmm. And like you were saying, that instead of fighting it and saying, well, it's got to be fixed or it's got to go away or it's going to be better, it can be better, but by accepting, okay, here's what it is. Here's what's happening. Here's how I feel. Here's what's going on. And once you're in that kind of a place of, like, now you can move forward, that's the beginning. So how do you move forward? So there are a lot of ways. You know, there's definitely therapy. There are some wonderful reading, and I'm a big fan, obviously, of books and of reading, and there are many, many 12-step programs that are very wonderful. 12-step is available for pretty much everything these days, and you know, in person, on the phone, on the internet. It's really very free and freely accessible. Sometimes you have to tool around to find the right meeting, but there's family 12-step, and there's for basically everything. So there's also inpatient programs. And there's more intensive therapies, a lot of different kind of therapies, and I think that different things work for different people at different times.
Yeah, exactly. I find that with mental health issues, you know. I had a young lady on the show, actually. She was on the phone from California, and we were talking, and she has bipolar and severe depression. And, you know, and she says, well, I don't take any medication. I says, okay, what do you do? She says, well, I'm very into holistic type, you know, symptom, you know, things to do. And I also exercise a lot. So I says, fine. Does it work for you? She says, well, it's working great. I said, well, keep it up. You know, it's like what it's working. Don't change it. You know, don't stop it.
Right.
I says, just understand that if it stops working, you may have to take a medication. You know, you may not like it, but you may have to, you know. But in the meantime, it's working. Hey, knock yourself out. You know, do it, you know. And whatever works for you, I'm a big, you know, advocate of. It doesn't necessarily have to mean medication, or it doesn't necessarily have to mean this, that, or the other. It's what works for you, you know.
Right. And sometimes it takes a little bit of talking to kind of understand, you know, what are the options. There's a lot of options out there. There's options within options. But to develop a personal path of knowing yourself and knowing the truths about yourself, this is what's needed. And it can be changing and growing, but to say,
right,
look, what actually is helpful and why, and how do I do that?
Quickly, do you find overall, on an average, that most treatment is effective?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
I think that we have to define effectiveness carefully. I really do have the idea that there's progress, not perfection.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there are a lot of effective treatments out there. And it's there's no quick fixes, though.
No, and, absolutely not.
When people are willing to stick with a treatment, and if it's not working or there's no benefit, that they talk with their practitioner, their provider, or their sponsor, or whoever they're working with, and say, doesn't seem to be working, I'm not getting what I think I need, then that's great, because you can either decide why not and see what can be worked from there, or you can decide what might be a different and next step to take. But when people continue on and keep at it, sure.
Well, let me ask you, a parent has a child, okay? It's just a hypothetical thing. And the child is a quote-unquote picky eater. Should they be worried?
Have left?
Oh, about 3 minutes.
Oh, 3 minutes. Oh, good. Thanks, Larry. You know, I don't know. I think that it depends on the other factors. You know, I think that nobody knows why people get eating disorders. There's a whole conglomeration of, you know, there's a lot of genetic information now, and family history and nature versus nurture, and certainly culture. And I think that one way that I always encourage parents, you know, to just be part of the solution. We all have to be part of the solution. We don't know who's really part of the problem. Certainly that can be worked out as well. But when there's a kid who's a picky eater, how a parent responds to that can really help. It can help or it can hurt. And it's challenging, especially for parents, mm-hmm, that have overweight kids. It's very painful,
right,
and you want your child to be healthy. All parents, you know, presumably want the best for their kid. So it depends how you tend to that and how you help your kid to tend to that. And, you know, worrisome behaviors are secretive behaviors. Certainly if there's a noticeable drop in weight, or you see cut marks, and these are things that you want to tend to more,
mm-hmm,
so. But, I mean, a lot of kids are picky eaters. That,
right,
doesn't mean they're going to have an eating disorder.
Right. How would someone reach out to you if they wanted to get a hold of you and, you know, either from email or phone, if you want to give out a phone number or whatever?
Yeah, pretty easy. I guess the easiest way is one of my two websites. One is melissagroman.com, and the other is a site called Recovery Hope and Healing, which has just some audio interviews with other healing professionals. So either way, my email and my phone number are on both of those sites.
And I strongly suggest to anyone out there to read Melissa's book, Better Is Not So Far Away. I found it was truly a wonderful, you know, I admit I only went 3/4 of the way, but I don't have a lot more to go.
I appreciate you reading that far.
You know, well, hey, you know, I would have liked to finish it, but like I said, I had some problems at home too.
Yeah.
But it is I think it's a wonderful piece of work, and the book contains many stories of people Melissa either is helping or has helped. And I personally found it very eye-opening and extremely informative. And I think that, you know, anybody who has someone or is someone who has some of these issues, they should read the book. because I think it can help in the long run. One more time, if you give out your websites that somebody can pick up on.
Sure. It's melissagroman.com or recoveryhopeandhealing.com.
Well, I really appreciate you being on today, Melissa, and I will tell you this. You are coming back. I will have you back on.
I would love to come back, Larry. Thank you so much.
I really would. And is there a special way to get your book? I mean, is it on Amazon or?
Yep, it should still be in some Barnes & Noble, I hope.
Okay.
But it's definitely on Amazon. That's probably the easiest way, or BarnesandNoble.com, I think, has
okay.
it also.
Okay. Melissa, I really appreciate the time you took to be here today, and I really mean it. I would like to have you back again. You know,
I would love to come back. Can I take a minute just to thank you very much again for having me and for really plugging the book? I really appreciate it. And I want to also wish you well with your son. I hope that the procedure goes smoothly and uneventfully today.
Yeah, I hope so, too, because that's where I'm going right after we get off here. You've been listening to Mental Health Matters, and we're back again next week on Monday from 2 to 3. So remember, folks, mental health really, truly does matter. See you next week.
USA Radio News. I'm Kelly Sloan. Today he addressed the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee and expressed concerns about Iran obtaining nuclear weapons.
American leaders worry about the security of their country. Israeli leaders worry about the survival of their country.
But many Democrats in Congress are refusing to attend Netanyahu's speech tomorrow before a joint session of Congress. The White House is upset House Republicans invited Netanyahu to speak. But AP correspondent Aaron Heller says the Iran issue cannot be ignored.
Could be the last chance for the prime minister to speak out and have any kind of influence on thwarting this emerging deal with Iran.
Secretary of State John Kerry says Iran doesn't want to build weapons with their nuclear program, but some experts disagree.
Iran continues to make progress, both in terms of uranium enrichment, in terms of its weaponization activities, in terms of its ballistic missile programs.
That was former U.S. Ambassador to Iran John Bolton in a Fox News interview. This is USA Radio News.
In the early 60s, Dolores and Ray Butcher and their three daughters earned a trip to Disneyland by collecting S&H green stamps. It was a dream come true. Today, nearly everyone has a wallet or keychain full of loyalty rewards cards that they use for discounts, gifts, and even free dinners at their favorite restaurants. For years, an international company has been offering a universal loyalty rewards card in Europe. Now they are looking for independent representatives to launch this card in the U.S. and Canada. We call it the Blue Card. One card to replace dozens. The Blue Card offers discounts, cash back, it even accumulates points to shop at participating merchants and an online mall. It's free to get the card and free to become a representative. You could help launch the Blue Card in your area and get paid wherever it's used. Imagine, you could get paid every time someone fills their gas tank, buys groceries, orders an online air ticket, or purchases just about anything. To get your free Blue Card, call 800-627-6620. 800-627-6620.
Consumer spending continues to slide, AP correspondent Matt Small reports.
The Commerce Department says consumer spending was down 0.2% in January following December's 0.3% dip, but economists had expected the decline, reflecting the big drop in gas prices, a decline that should prove to be a positive for the economy moving forward, giving consumers more money to spend on other things. Meanwhile, income grew 0.3% in January as worker pay increased. Analysts expect solid job gains and low unemployment will boost consumer spending and economic growth this year in what they predict will be the fastest pace in a decade. Matt Small, Washington.
The U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments in a case involving voter-approved commissions that draw a state's congressional district boundaries. Arizona Republicans are objecting. The big issue before the court is whether voters can take away the power given by the U.S. Constitution to elected state legislatures. The decision could affect 12 states. This is USA Radio News.
You hear that, kid? That's the hum of a well-run facility. You know what I hate hearing? Silence. Silence on a production line means downtime. Downtime means wasted time. Wasted time means wasted money. Silence isn't golden, kid. It's deadly. That's why I love Grainger. With a wide variety of the latest products, Grainger gets us what we need when we need it to help keep this place up and running and humming away. Get it? Got it? Good. Call, click Grainger.com, or stop by. Grainger, for the ones We'll get it done.
Kentucky Senator Rand Paul has won the Conservative Political Action Conference's annual presidential preference straw poll, his third win. He spoke about America's priorities.